And what a joy it is to know that he hears and answers prayer. And thank you again for being a part of this vital ministry. Thank you so much for joining with us in a time for prayer. Again, if you would like to write to us at a time for prayer, our mailing address is A Time for Prayer, in care of radio station KFER, P.O. Box 13, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. And thank you for the cards and letters that you've sent in, and for the contributions, financial support. That's what makes this program possible. And again, if you'd like to send a check to support this ministry, please make the check payable to KFER. But don't forget to mention on the check this program, A Time for Prayer. And then again, if you'd like to correspond with us, perhaps with personal needs and prayer requests, you can write to us at A Time for Prayer, P.O. Box 2032, Crescent City, California, 95531. Again, that's A Time for Prayer, P.O. Box 2032, Crescent City, California, 95531. It will be a joy to hear from you. And remember, we stand with you in prayer. And we have the assurance that you stand with us in prayer. And what a joy that is. And until next time, may God bless you exceedingly abundantly above all that you're able to think or ask. Amen.
Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being because, we're hoping to have our special guest tonight, Jim Mars, on the line, who's written a book called The War on America, which we carry, incidentally. But the line seems to be busy, so let's just give a little of the background to the war on America, the terrorist war on America. In fact, it was very interesting. This week I had the opportunity to talk to a gentleman who was in military intelligence. He's been in military intelligence for some time, and we were talking on a different subject, but the idea of the war on terrorism and the war with the terrorists came up, and he scoffed. You know, he said, I'm privy to all of these top-level military intelligence directives. He said there's no war on terrorism. I mean, this is a total distraction. He said there really are people, domestic terrorists, that we should be concerned about, some of these crazy people here in this country, the skinheads and the radicals and extremists. But as far as the threat, the external threat of Islamic terrorism, it just isn't true. And, of course, initially I was a little shocked at what he said, and yet as I thought of this, it's really very obvious. We did have this so-called attack in Washington, D.C., but was that because people were beginning to question the president on the weapons of mass destruction, the phony weapons of mass destruction? Do you remember that shortly after the 9/11 attack, about 3 weeks later, why we had the so-called anthrax attack on America. Now, they knew this was coming. Why? How do I know they knew it was coming? Because on the evening of 9/11, Dick Cheney and everybody and his White House staff started on Cipro, and it's not something you would take ordinarily. You wouldn't take Cipro unless you knew there was a very real threat of anthrax, because Cipro is specific for anthrax, and Cipro has potential complications. You can take it, and it'll cause your Achilles tendon or other tendons to rupture. So you wouldn't take something like that unless you knew there was going to be an attack or suspected there was going to be an attack. And if you suspected there would be an attack, why wouldn't you tell other people so they could protect themselves as well? And, of course, obviously they didn't bother to tell anybody else. They just protected themselves. And how did they know, or why did they suspect there was going to be an anthrax attack, of all things? Well, I suspect that, as somebody once said, reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it will be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And so let me take you back a ways. We know, for instance, in the early 1980s, after we had brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power in Iran, and you really have to understand that it was in 1979 that we toppled the Shah of Iran, and we brought the Ayatollah to power. And I can remember, I'm old enough to remember thinking at the time, why would the American government topple an ally who had the sixth largest army in the world, who was a bulwark against communism, who was certainly a firm friend of the United States? We had put him in power after we toppled Mossadegh, Premier Mossadegh, back in 1953. Incidentally, one of the men involved in that topple was a man named Colonel Schwarzkopf. That was, of course, Norman Schwarzkopf's father. and Colonel Schwarzkopf was with the police. I worked with the CIA, and this is covered in Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. You can index read that for Schwarzkopf. You'll find out how, of course, the power goes from generation to generation to the chosen few who are selected to work behind the scenes or perhaps work in key positions for the Brotherhood of Darkness, the people who rule the world. Well, anyway, in 1959, why we, certainly, pardon me, 1979, why Saddam Hussein came to power with our blessing. We toppled the Shah of Iran, and we brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power. And then it was that same time, in about December of that 1979, when the United States began funding Mujahideen, the holy warriors in Afghanistan, who were opposing the Soviet puppet government. There was a small puppet government in Afghanistan that overthrown the king. They were in power, and we began funding their opposition, the holy warriors there, Mujahideen. And of course, it was known very well that once we began destabilizing the Soviet government, which is just on the border of the Soviet Union, the Soviets would intervene militarily, and that's exactly what we wanted. In fact, the book written by the foreign correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, which we have in our library, talks about how Zygmunt Brzezinski, a decade later, admitted that he intentionally precipitated that war. Why? Well, because we wanted an excuse to send our troops into Afghanistan, or at least to finance the troops in Afghanistan. And that's exactly what did happen. We, of course, sent our money. The CIA began funding the Mujahideen. And then we went all over the world recruiting Islamic warriors to come to fight in this holy war against the infidels. And we began indoctrinating these people in this radical form of Islamic fundamentalism, the same that was being practiced in Iran at that time under the Ayatollah Khomeini. You see, there was almost no Islamic fundamentalism prior to 1980. Oh, there was the Muslim Brotherhood that had been formed in 1928, but it didn't have any power and influence, and most Muslims simply wanted to live their lives and go on with their life. But unfortunately, we had different plans. So we began then to fund with massive amounts of money the Mujahideen, bringing them to Afghanistan, training them in all sorts of means of warfare and explosives and various methods of killing, because that's what, of course, you do when you're training soldiers. You train them how to kill. And, of course, it was during that time that we financed textbooks that were used in Afghanistan to indoctrinate the youth in this radical form of Islam. And any of you who doubt that, we have an article out of the Washington Post telling you exactly that, how we funded the Islamic terrorist movement. Well, Dr. Stan here. Right now, of course, we're going to have to discontinue this discussion. Maybe we'll get on with it someday in the future. But right now, we have with us on the line Jim Mars. Hi, Jim. How are you doing?
Hey, Dr. Stan. Good to be with you.
Well, Jim Mars has, of course, written a number of excellent books. He wrote a book on the Kennedy assassination. Was Crossfire?
That's right.
And then, of course, that sold, what, 1 million books, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. Plus.
And then, of course, he wrote another book, which we've interviewed him on the past, Ruled by Secrecy.
Right. It
goes into all the secret societies we talk about here. And what did that sell, about 500,000?
Yeah, that's been on up there, and that's despite the fact that I was, I guess, essentially blackballed by the mass media, you know, but word of mouth got around, a lot of people bought it, and then they'd tell everybody, and they bought some more, ended up on the extended New York Times bestseller list.
And I think we still have copies of that, we still carry it because we think it's an important book.
That's right.
But, of course, now, of course, after 9/11, Jim wrote another book, War on Freedom. Why don't you tell our listeners what happened to that book in Free America, where we have Freedom of the Press?
That's right, Freedom of the Press. Well, I had a contract with HarperCollins in New York, and my editor was really fired up. What I did was assemble all the information having to do with the 9/11 attacks, the questions, the unanswered questions, and then the subsequent events, the invasion of Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq, and the fact that all of these were planned years ago, all in fact in a position paper published back during the first Bush administration, they said all we need is a Pearl Harbor type attack to, you know, get the public stampeded and we can get what we want. And that's exactly what's happened. And, they were so fired up in New York, they said, man, this is going to sell a million. And, it went through the legal review, which means they always check to make sure that you're not telling lies and that everything is at least attributed, if not substantiated. And that passed that and everything was cool. And then some upper official who, had not even read the book just decided they had to cancel it because the only excuse I ever heard was they did not want to upset the families of 9/11 victims.
So which, they paid you off the money that
they
had promised.
And then they paid me off all the advance money and said, basically, here, you know, sit down and go away.
And, of course, they gave you the manuscript back, so you were able to publish it on your own. But, you know, when you don't have a big publishing house, a distribution system, it's really
hard
to get a book out.
That's right. And that is the control of the media in this country. It's not that they can control every writer and every editor. No way. But they control the distribution of the information.
And
if it doesn't get on CNN or Fox or the Associated Press, then most people don't see it. And if you don't see it or read it, then as far as you know, it didn't happen.
And you have to understand that the CIA works within the media here in the United States.
Absolutely.
That's covered in a book titled Fixing Intelligence by General Odom, who at one time headed the NSA. And in this book, which came out maybe a year ago, he mentioned several times the impropriety or his concern about the fact that the CIA had people stationed within our media here influencing what the American people think. So I can tell you that they have them with most of the major publishing houses, and that the CIA doesn't want you to get the information. You're just not going to get it.
That's
and
right.
Of course, I mean, if you listen to Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly, they're paid very, very well not to reveal the truth.
That's right.
They can see
they reveal what they're told to reveal.
Right. And that's why...
Doc Stan, you know, of course, this is nothing new. I'm reminded of the verse in the Bible that says, seek the truth and ye shall find it, and the truth will set you free. It doesn't say turn on the TV and you'll find the truth, or open the newspaper and you'll find the truth. It said seek. So in other words, everybody has to go out and really look for it and do their homework, do their studying, and then they can find the truth.
Well, of course, we've got to make them realize that they're not getting the truth. I think the hardest thing for me to accept when I got started in this battle some 42 years ago was that the media was controlled in America. And
right.
It took me the longest time of checking things back and forth and going to the original source material to realize that most of what's in the newspaper just isn't true. Now, once in a while, they do something sneak in there. I mean, they can't print nothing but lies. So I read the newspapers because once in a while I'll find something, maybe once a week or twice a week, that really is revealing. Do you find the same thing?
Absolutely.
But so much really is not true.
But you have to read with discernment. You can't just accept everything at face value. And you know what? Let me give you a classic example. This is something I was going to bring up to you tonight in our little talk, which is that where are the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? You know, they're not there. And this is nothing new. If you've been paying attention before the hue and cry to rush to war prior to the invasion last spring, you would know that they're not there. Hans Blix, the UN weapons inspector, said they don't have them. Our own weapons inspector, Scott Ritter, said they don't have them. The International Atomic Energy Agency, which is tasked with monitoring nuclear weapons in Iraq, said they don't have them. You know, it was only the Bush administration that said they had them. And now, this leads us to where we are right now, which I find highly illuminating. Instead of the mass media in this country now saying, hey, George, why did you tell us that? Why did you lie to us? Why? What do you have a hidden agenda? What are you doing here? No. Now the big question this week and for the next few weeks is going to be, where was the intelligence failure?
Why did they tell me the wrong thing?
And then, who's responsible for giving me this wrong information? And the media buys right into that. Hey, let me tell you something. The evidence was there all along, wasn't it, Stan?
Well, of course, they've wanted to go into Iraq for a long time. If you go to the material put out by the Project for the New American Century, and you can go to their website, newamericancentury.org, you'll find that they had the plans already made in 1988, the new book, The Price of Loyalty, written with the support of Paul O'Neill, says that, you know, here it is, January of the year 2001, they're in the White House at the meetings in the Oval Office, and they're all talking about how are we going to get into a war with Iraq?
I know it.
And of course, that was the question, how are we going to get the American people to go along with this war we want in Iraq? And Paul O'Neill said, nobody asked, why are we going to war in Iraq? Nobody said, are we justified in going to war with Iraq? It was, we're going to go to a war, we need some means of getting the American people to go along with it. That's the underlying theme. And, of course, 9-1-1 was that justifying theme.
Yeah, and let me tell you this. This is really fascinating because a couple of weeks ago when that Paul O'Neill thing came up and was kind of a little hot topic, I happened to catch a edition of NBC News, and they actually had the soundbite from Paul O'Neill when he's saying, I was in the cabinet meetings and said all the talk was how to get in and how best to accomplish it, and said there was no discussion as to should we do this and why is this necessary. And so here's what I found interesting is that NBC, in an effort to be balanced in their news presentation, actually then turned and went to an administration spokesman, and he follows on the heels of Paul O'Neill's statements by saying, well, we had a real problem with Paul O'Neill, said he'd say things, and we didn't know how to respond, which was, I guess, that was their rebuttal. And yet I'm thinking, what a beautiful, classic explanation of what's going on. The guy raises moral, ethical questions, and they don't know how to respond.
Well, they've known this thing was coming down the line for a long time. We read the report of the National Commission on Terrorism in the 21st century. I think there were 14 people on the commission. 13 of them came from the CFR. And the report, Phase 1 report, 1999, they were talking about, you know, the terrorist attacks that are coming on America. This is 1999.
Right.
And the year 2000... Well,
they ought to know, right?
In the year 2000, they came up with a whole plan for the Office of Homeland Security. That's Phase 3. And incidentally, we offer these reports to Radio Liberty, although they're rather expensive. But they are available if you don't want to pull them down off the Internet. Actually, there was a Paul Bremer report. You know who Bremer is, of course. He's the current dictator over there in Iraq. He comes from the Kissinger and Associates. He wrote a report, and you can get that down off the Internet, or we actually have it. He's talking about, of course, when the terrorist attacks are coming, not if. This is in the year 2000, not if they're coming, but when they come, we've got to have a military dictatorship. And he starts this whole thing out with a discussion of Pearl Harbor. How Pearl Harbor just came about because they were just totally inept. The military was inept. The intelligence was inept. And it was just sort of like, this is the line we're going to use to sell this to the American people.
And it was a line because, Dr. Stan, I know that you have done your homework, and so you understand that it is now pretty much beyond question that certain people in high positions in Washington, namely Franklin Roosevelt, George Marshall, they knew Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked. Not only did they know it was going to be attacked, when and where, but they also precipitated it by closing off Japan's oil supplies in the summer of 1941.
Yeah, in fact, I even have the pages out of Secretary of War Simpson's diary. Incidentally, he was skull and bones, just like George W. and John Kerry. But Secretary of War Simpson talked about going to a meeting in the White House on the 25th of November, where the president said, "The war is coming. The only question, it may be this coming Monday. It'll probably be Sunday or Monday. The only question is, how will we get into the war, get the Japanese to fire the first shot, and have as little possible damage to our forces as possible?"
Yeah.
Then we only lost 3,000 men. Wasn't it worth that to get into the war that they wanted so badly?
That's right.
Well, let's get into what you have found that points to the fact that they knew the attack was coming, and that's why there were no planes in the air that morning. That's why, of course, the people in the South Tower were ordered to stay at their position, even though they could see the North Tower in flames and people jumping out the windows, but the orders came in over the loudspeaker, stay at your desk, stay at your desk. Everything was done to make sure there'd be the maximum number of casualties. And then the strange way that those buildings came down. And you might explain the Twin Towers, but how about Building 6? How about Building 7?
Yeah.
Well, why did you pick it up?
Silverstein, the guy that owns the complex, even, I don't know if this was a slip of the tongue, I don't know if he was suddenly blurted out the truth, but he talked about the demolition of the building.
The demolition of the buildings. We're going to be back in just a minute. I'm going to keep quiet and let Jim Mars talk, because he has a wealth of information on what really happened in the United States on September 11, 2001, the War on Freedom. We'll be right back here with Jim Mars. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Jim Mars. Jim, why don't you pick up the story? What is the evidence that they had prior knowledge?
Well, it's there's so much of it, it's hard to find a starting place. I think a couple of things that stick in my mind are, number one, back in either 1995 or 96 in the Philippines, the Philippine authorities busted an Al-Qaeda cell. And on their computers and in their paperwork, they found the plans for something called Operation Bojinka. And this was a plan to hijack airplanes and fly them into public buildings. So, in other words, 6 years before it happened, U.S. authorities were fully informed of all this. They knew that that was a plan that the Al-Qaeda terrorists had in mind for attacking America.
But did they name specifically the World Trade Center in that?
That name came up, yes.
In fact, they named five sites.
And by the way, people seem to forget that in 1993, they bombed the World Trade Center.
Sure.
You know, have we forgotten that? And it was just fortunate that they were so inept that it didn't bring down either of those towers. But still, it caused $1 million worth of damage and injured a whole lot of people. But I think the thing that we have to take note of the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center is the fact that the FBI had an inside man.
Mr. Salem, right?
Yeah. They had a guy who was an Egyptian army officer who was working with these terrorists who reported back to the FBI that they were going to bomb the World Trade Center. And he thought that was just, terrible. And he said, I think I can slip in phony explosives for the real explosives, and then we can catch them red-handed, and they won't do any damage. And his FBI superiors said no.
And they fired him. They forced him to withdraw because they wanted to wear a wire, and he said, no, I was promised I wouldn't have to do that. Well, you're going to have to testify. No, he said, they'll kill my family. You're giving me no protection. You want me to risk my life? Will you do this or else? And he said, all right, if that's the way you're going to be. And so he quit.
That's right.
They bombed
the World Trade Center.
Right. So it's, they had the advantage.
Come on, folks. Hello. Pearl Harbor, it was going to happen, allowed it to happen to further their political agenda. Operation Northwoods, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which is back in the 60s. This is a plan when the Bay of Pigs failed. Kennedy turned over the secret war against Castro and took it away from the CIA, gave it to the Pentagon. Pentagon put their best minds on it, and they came up with Operation Northwoods, which was a plan to hijack airliners, bomb buildings, kill people, and blame it on Castro. And that got approved by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It was only Kennedy who said, hey, wait a minute, we're not going to do this. This is not what we're all about.
In fact, if you want to read the complete text of Operation Northwood, which at once was top secret and has been declassified, that is available in total in our syllabus entitled The War in Iraq, The Untold Story. That's Iraq, The Untold Story. It's also covered in a book by James Bovard, which we carry. So you can get the complete text of Operation Northwood. Of course, Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly aren't going to tell you about that.
That's true, and shameless plug here, I also cover Operation Northwoods in my book, The War on Freedom.
All right, you have to get Jim's book,
which is available there from Dr. Stan, or you can go visit my website, JimMars, that's with two R's, .com.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this afternoon is evening is Jim Mars. We're talking about Operation Northwood, which was a Joint Chiefs of Staff plan to kill people, sink boats with Americans on them or with Cubans on them and blame it on Fidel Castro, to blow up John Glenn's rocket when it went up into space, to blame it on Fidel Castro, or to shoot down an airliner that appeared to be loaded with people so that they could blame it on Castro and precipitate a war. That was what it was really all about. Fortunately, the President of the United States said he wasn't going to go along with it, and shortly thereafter, General Lemitzer, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who'd come up with this bizarre sort of program, was relieved of his position. But there really are people who would precipitate an incident and kill lots of people to justify going to war. It's Operation Northwood, and we have copies. It's covered in Jim Mars' book, The War on Freedom, and if you want to know, we'll talk more about how to get that later in the program. It's an excellent book. We recommend it to you. Or if you want to see the original text, it's included in my syllabus, Iraq, the Untold Story. But Jim does an excellent job of covering that. So pick up the rest of the story there, Jim.
Well, you know, the thing is, once we understand that, this is nothing new. We all know Hitler invaded Poland in September of 1939, but what most people don't know or forgot is that he didn't just suddenly launch an attack into Poland. It was all based on a phony incident that the Nazis themselves contrived. They got some Polish prisoners, dressed them in Polish army uniforms, and then put them around this German radio station near the Polish border, shot them, and then called in international reporters and said, look, the Poles have attacked our radio station. We, you know, across the border. We cannot put up with this provocation. And that was the excuse he used to launch the invasion of Poland, which precipitated World War II. There's always some pretext. Nobody just says, oh, well, we're just going to go to war. You know, no, there's always got to be some pretext.
Like a Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Exactly. And when you look at that, you look at the Hitler and the Polish soldiers at the radio station, and then you look at the Gulf of Tonkin, and you look at the Operation Northwoods, and then, you know, on and on and on. Come on, can't we wake up? Can't we start thinking about these things that happen instead of just knee-jerk reaction? Within an hour of the attacks on September the 11th, well, you know, I think everybody else is still sitting around in shock going, holy cow, they piled those planes in that building. My God, you know, what in the world is going on? Nobody was even sure of what had happened, and yet within an hour or so, they're already naming the suspect.
In fact,
Osama bin Laden did this. And all I can think of is that sounds like an hour after the Kennedy assassination. They said, well, we've arrested this guy. It's Lee Harvey Oswald. He did it all by himself. How pat. How easy. How contrived. And now, of course, it's taken us 40 years, but nobody buys Oswald anymore. You know? Well, why in the heck can't we just look at what's going on and stop and think about it and say, wait a minute, could this have been a contrived attack? Well, it certainly could have, particularly just in the broadest overview, when you stop and consider, the Al-Qaeda terrorist network was created by our CIA to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. Osama bin Laden, the son of this wealthy Saudi Arabian businessman.
A friend of George W. Herbert Walker Bush, too.
Exactly. Close friends of the Bushes. And, you know, he's identified as the key culprit. And yet, where's the evidence? I still have not seen any hard evidence, and I'm not saying that he wasn't involved or wasn't behind the 9/11 attacks. He might have been. I'm simply saying I've not seen any hard evidence to prove that he was. And even if they were to bring the hard evidence forward, I want to see the evidence as to who is behind Osama bin Laden. And what we're finding out now, and this is the reason that the Bush administration has continually dragged their feet on this Congressional Joint Committee that's investigating 9/11, is because the most secret, the most sensitive thing they've got is the involvement of the Saudi Arabians in that attack. Now, the FBI has told us that 15 of the 19 identified hijackers are Saudi Arabians. we are now finding out that the Saudi Arabia and their Muslim charities all around the world are the ones that are bankrolling the terrorists. And we do know, and it's a matter of public record, that the Bush family and the Bin Laden family are not only business partners, but social friends. In the year 2000, the Bushes flew to Saudi Arabia as personal guests of the Bin Ladens. Now, all that just sounds a little bit cozy to me. When you put two and two together, those facts, plus the facts that all through history, they have used provocations to start wars and to advance their own agendas. I just think we need to take a really serious look at what's going on.
Well, we'll be back here in just a moment with Jim Mars right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and we're talking with Jim Mars, author of The War on Freedom. And if you want to know more about the book, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. But right now we've got Terry calling from Santa Cruz. Terry, did you have a question or comment?
Well, yes, I found it really fascinating that your guest mentioned the Gulf of Tonkin incident, because just yesterday in my house, a friend came by and visited, and he was on a naval ship in the Gulf of Tonkin at that time. And when he heard there was an attack on a nearby ship, they talked to some of the crew by radio, and they said the crew on the supposedly attacked ship said, "Well, it's news to us." And my friend was on a tanker that refueling ships in the Gulf, and when they went to refuel that ship, they noticed painted bullet holes on the ship, and the crew members told my friend that they were ordered by the captain to paint the bullet holes on the ship. Now, what's interesting is that the Spanish, was it the Spanish-American War started the same way?
The Spanish-American War, the battleship Maine, right.
In the harbor in Cuba, right?
Right.
Yeah, that was sunken. Well, what's really interesting, and I think we all need to go another level higher in our studies, is to know that the captains of those ships were under the direct orders of the Jesuits and the Knights of Malta, who controlled the Freemasons. Both of those skippers were Catholics, under orders to do what they did.
All right, fine. Well, thanks so very much. And, of course, we actually have off the Internet the work by Admiral Rickover that suggests that this was not a mine. The explosion did not come from without, but from within on that ship. And it's the same pattern over and over again. Thanks so very much. Right.
But look to the Jesuits.
Well, I thank you so much for calling. Okay, let's go ahead, Jim.
Well, but the caller's right. You know, this just goes all the way back through history. And the thing is, I can't help but think of the old adage that says, "Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me."
Right.
You know, I mean, how long do we have to put up with this before people start thinking about what's really going on and figuring out what's, are we just going to be like a herd of sheep and just get, you know, chased by the wolves or the dogs from one pillar to another?
Well, of course, we know that there was some advanced knowledge because we actually checked the story out that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle. Incidentally, it was pulled out of the Chronicle after one showing, but pointing out that Willie Brown, the mayor of San Francisco, was called at 10 o'clock the previous evening, the September 11th, and told to be very cautious. Flying the next day, I talked to his press secretary. They confirmed the fact. My friend, Dr. Garth Nicholson, was told that there would be an attack on the 11th of September by high government officials on the Pentagon. So well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest is Jim Mars. We're talking about the background of what happened on September 11th. So why don't you pick up the story from there, Jim?
Right. Well, you know, it wasn't just Willie Brown, the mayor of San Francisco, who was warned not to be flying. In August of 2001, the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, suddenly quit flying commercial aircraft and would only take government chartered aircraft. Also, Pentagon officials also quit flying commercial aircraft. Now, my question is, in this land of the free, home of the brave, with our elected representatives, what did they know that they didn't tell us?
Well, I think it's so interesting you bring that up, because this was reported in Newsweek, and we have the articles immediately after 9/11, and then, of course, I think September 24th. So it was actually two articles out of Newsweek that said that on the 10th of September, Pentagon officials, the Defense Department officials, canceled their flights for the 11th of September. So they obviously had to suspect that something was going to be happening on the 11th of September. And
right.
So interesting about that is Newsweek magazine just refuses to talk about the two articles that were in there, a week apart. And the second one was on 10/24 in Newsweek magazine.
How's that for freedom of the press?
Right.
They won't even discuss their own articles. I mean, come on, man. And that's what I'm saying. The way the media, of course, you got to understand, the media is not a separate animal. It's not that we have politics here and the public there and the media over there and business over here. It's like all of the mass media are owned by the very big, large multinational corporations who are pouring all that money into George Bush's political coffers. And they control it because money talks. And so when the rest of the world here about a year ago was saying, well, you know, Bush is lying about weapons of mass destruction, the media in this country, well, to quote U.S. News and World Report, how the administration crafted its case. See, they didn't lie to us. They just crafted their case. Okay? And today, when everybody's becoming well aware of the fact that they haven't found any weapons of mass destruction, just as so many people in so many other countries were trying to tell us, even before we invaded that country, that people are beginning to wake up. So now Bush says he's going to appoint a big, you know, blue ribbon committee to look in to find out these intelligence failures. There was no intelligence failure, okay? They lied about what was going on. And yet the media today, and like I said, you hadn't watched. The next few weeks, we're going to see all these stories about, oh, we got to get to the bottom of the intelligence failure, and who was behind that, and, oh, let's hear from the CIA, let's hear from the NRO, let's hear from the NSA. You know, what's wrong with you guys? Nothing's wrong with those guys. Okay. It's the political leadership where the problem is, and yet they will not talk about it.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, I don't know if you're acquainted with Kristen Breitweiser's testimony.
Oh, yes.
Before the Senate Intelligence Select Committee. But we reproduced that, and I think it's my October 2002 newsletter. Anybody out there who wants a copy of it, I'll be glad to send it to them. We just reproduced her testimony in total, and she pointed out that, of course, the government had claims that they had no knowledge that there was going to be an attack. They didn't know who these people were. They weren't monitoring them. They had nobody within the Islamic terrorist movement here. They just couldn't get anybody inside. But within 2 hours of the attack, FBI agents who had no idea who these people were, who had no idea the attack was coming, within 2 hours of the attack, they were at the restaurants where the hijackers ate.
Yeah, and the hotels where they'd lived, right. And the airports where they'd taken flight training.
Now, how could that possibly be, ladies and gentlemen? You're logical out there. You're listening. If you want that letter, you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, or you can go up on the Internet and put in Google and Kristen Breitweiser's Select Committee testimony, or my RadioLiberty.com is my website, and it's the October 2002 newsletter, as I remember. Read this, what this woman said. Her husband, Ron, died at the South Tower. And she is one of the most courageous people, defying the leaders of this country and saying, I think there's a cover-up, and I do too. Don't you?
Let me ask you this, Dr. Stan. Do you think that Karen Breitweiser would have been offended with the facts that I put together in my book, War on Freedom?
No, I don't think so at all. I
don't think so either. In fact, I think those families of all of them deserve the truth.
But, of course, we can't let the American people know that any more than you could have let the American people in 1942 know that they left those boys at Pearl Harbor to die.
Well, excuse me, I think there's a huge difference here. Back in 1941-42, number one, it became very obvious that we probably needed to get in that war to stop the Nazis and to stop Japanese militarism. And I think I'm not defending this. I'm simply explaining this. I can see where political leaders might, especially like Franklin Roosevelt, who campaigned and won an unprecedented fourth term by pledging to keep us out of war. And yet I could see where he got caught between the rock and the hard place, and he knows we've got to get in, but he knows he can't just declare war. There's got to be something. So when he sees this Japanese attack coming on Pearl Harbor, then I can see at least where he could justify to himself sitting back and allowing it to happen so that we get a whole nation off and galvanized and marching in lockstep into this wartime situation. But this isn't 1941 or 42. We're talking about invasions of third world, poor, destitute, already bombed out countries that cannot put up any kind of meaningful resistance to the last remaining superpower in the world, the United States of America. And don't you think that there's a little bit of difference between what happened then and what happened now?
I think the 3,000 boys died at Pearl Harbor, and about the same number died on the World Trade Center.
That's true.
But we could debate this. I simply point out who financed Adolf Hitler, who encouraged Adolf Hitler, who financed and helped the Japanese at every turn prior to the war. And, of course, when the Japanese tried to surrender, who refused to accept their surrender for 6 months until after we'd dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Right, which was not so much about forcing Japan to surrender. They were already trying to. That was about intimidating the Russians.
Yeah, okay. So
now, by the way, since we're talking about who financed Hitler, I think your audience needs to be reminded that one of the American financiers who was actually prosecuted under the Trading with the Enemy Act in late 1942 was a banker, and he was stripped of his holdings in something called Union Banking Corporation because it was all that business he was doing was traced right back to Fritz Thyssen, the steel magnate in Germany, who was the principal financier of Hitler. So here's the guy who's working on behalf of Hitler and the Nazis in this country, and it was none other than Prescott Bush, the grandfather of our current president and the father of our former president, George Herbert Walker Bush. And I think people need to understand this, because I don't think that's some sort of coincidence or some sort of blip in history. I think it shows us that there are agendas behind the headlines that we see every day that could tell us more about what's really going on than the controlled mass media.
I agree with you totally. Let's go ahead there, Jim. And I don't think the average person knows that Prescott Bush actually working for the Brown Brothers and Harriman, and that bank was actually involved in financing Adolf Hitler, not only before the war, but during the war itself.
That's right.
Why he got into trouble.
And it was Brown Brothers Harriman, by the way, that a CIA official named Krongard suddenly left the CIA just months before the 9/11 attacks and was working through Brown Brothers Harriman and the Deutsche Bank. And that is where, if everybody would stretch their memory back, they'll recall that in the days following the 9/11 attacks, we were told that there was some very suspicious short selling of stock. It was these put options, okay, which allows people to clean up if the stock drops. And that was done on American Airlines, United Airlines, and their insurance carriers. This, according to the news reports at the time, was very, very strong evidence that somebody had foreknowledge of these attacks and was working to profit from them. And we were told that the FBI and the federal government were going to track these stock transactions and see if they didn't lead to Osama bin Laden. And if we'll stop and think, we've never heard any more out of that.
Yeah, but they've sure been busy tracking down that terrible and dangerous criminal, Martha Stewart.
That's right.
Right, but we just can't find out who it was who was doing those shorts and made all that money. And it wasn't simply in the United States, it was in Europe as well. So on all the major markets, they were shorting these.
And it was Brown Brothers, Harriman, and Deutsche Bank, which was rife with CIA guys. They knew it was going to happen, and they wanted to profit from it.
Well, I mentioned earlier that my friend, Dr. Garth Nicholson, and I would be willing to stake my life that what he told me was true, had been notified by a high government official there was going to be an attack on the Pentagon on September 11th. He had contacts in government. He passed the information on. He sent emails to both Joyce Riley and to to Alex Jones. At least he told me he had, and they seem to remember getting them, although they, nobody still has the emails that he sent. So obviously some people knew. David Shippers was told by people in the FBI who could not come forward there was going to be an attack on Lower Manhattan in the early part of September. And he went to Washington, D.C., tried to reach Ashcroft, who he knew, and other people in government. The most amazing thing, when he told them what he wanted to inform them about the coming attack, nobody wanted to talk to him. Why would that be?
Well, let me give you this one, and Dr. Stan, we haven't discussed this, so I'll be interested to get your take on this. Back in about June of last year, 2 years ago almost now, 2002, when the Joint Congressional Committee to Study 9/11 was starting up, and they heard testimony from Norman Mineta, who was then Secretary of Transportation, and he testified to them that on the morning of 9/11, just after the second plane had hit the South Tower of the World Trade Center, but before anything had hit the Pentagon, that he hurried to the Situation Room, the bunker as they call it, in the White House, and of course Bush was in Florida reading a little story about the billy goats or something, but Cheney was there. And he said while he was in there, this is his testimony, he said a young man ran in and ran up to Cheney and he said, the plane is 50 miles out. And then a little while later he ran in, he said, the plane is 30 miles out. And then he ran in and said, the plane's 20 miles out. And at this point he asked Cheney, he said, do the orders still stand? And he said, and Mineta said that Cheney acted very, you know, angered. And he said, what makes you think the orders don't stand? And chastised, the guy went away. Okay, and of course, a few short time later, whatever it was, barreled into the Pentagon.
Well,
now, my question to you is, what do you suppose these orders were?
Well, you know, I would love to get that. I've been up on the web looking for that, and I haven't been able to find it. I hope you have that, because I would just love to see that. All I see about his testimony was that he kept giving the official party line. Now, there must be other testimony other than what I've been able to get off the web. Do you have that?
I'll have to go search my files. I'll let you know if I can come up with it. But I know that just a month or two after that, supposedly that testimony was given, that it was up there. But, of course, you and I both know that things tend to disappear off the net.
They sure do. And this is what's so frightening, is that it'll be up there, and if you don't make a copy of it, why, somebody from the CIA gets up there, and it's gone forever. It's sort of like those passports. There was two passports that just mysteriously appeared. One right adjacent to the World Trade Center,
yeah,
the other there.
Yeah, from Mohammed Atta.
Right, and of course, I figured they must have. These were both from the Islamic terrorists, and so they must have rolled down the window and actually thrown them out before the planes crashed.
That's right.
But
the black boxes that were designed to withstand crashes didn't survive, but these paper passports did.
Right, and we happen to have the picture of one of them that was on the FBI webpage, and obviously they must have been the Islamic terrorists, because there's the passport. That the one thing that survived the flaming inferno was the passport. We've got Terry back again. Terry, did you have another comment? Do you have a question for our guest?
Well, what's your guest's name?
His name is Jim Mars. He's written a book called The War on Terror.
Is that Texas brother?
No, it's independent.
No,
right? It's spelled the same way, but not his brother.
Right. Well, you know, a little while ago he mentioned, and you were talking about Prescott Bush and Brown and Harriman and the financing of
Hitler
and such. And, you know, Hitler, Mussolini, and Franco were all three completely supported and financed by the Catholic Church.
Well, you know, it's not a matter of record.
Well,
and I think
Dave Emery can fill you in quite well.
Who can?
Dave Emery.
Dave Emery. Okay, well, we'll have Dave on here, and we'll be talking
about
that.
We've had him on before,
that.
And he's talked about it, but you obfuscate the problem here.
I really believe that he has not said that the major force behind Franco and Mussolini and Adolf Hitler was a Catholic
Church.
Wait a minute.
Who restored the Pope?
Go ahead. Go ahead, Jim. Jim?
Oh, me. Okay.
Right, I mean,
he wants
to come on and bash. I mean, there's a lot of problems with the Catholic Church, but I just don't think that anybody can say that the major force behind Adolf Hitler was a Catholic Church, because
record shows that is really not true.
Right.
The major force behind Hitler was, number one, the very secret Thule Society, which is closely connected to the Freemasons, if anything, and with the bankers in France and England and America.
Sure, and certainly the Round Table group. In fact, the reason that Hess flew to America, and we have two books on that. One is Prisoner Number 27 and Motive for a Mission. The reason that Hess flew to England during the war was, of course, to contact the Round Table group.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that's interesting you mentioned that. I have a new book out called The Sisterhood of the Rose, and it is what I call a work of faction. It's fact-based fiction. And one of the instances that I write about in there, using my heroine as the narrator and as the focus of all this happened, was this plot by British intelligence to include the occultist Aleister Crowley. And they worked through a British Secret Service agent by the name of Ian Fleming, if that name rings a bell to anybody. If you've ever seen a James Bond movie, this was the guy who created James Bond and wrote all the James Bond novels. And during the war, he was instrumental in getting Hitler's deputy, Rudolf Hess, to fly to England. And they did that through occultism. They did that by meeting in Switzerland with some German astrologers and convinced them that the stars were propitious and that they should tell Hess to fly to England and he could probably secure a peace agreement between England and Germany. And of course he flew there and he was immediately arrested by a farmer with a pitchfork and thrown in prison and never released.
And of course, his crime, why he wanted, of course, to have peace. It was a man who sent him, was a man named Haushofer, you're right, deeply involved with the occult. We've got Ari calling. Hi, Ari, do you have a question or comment?
Yes, hi. I just noticed on the internet that your guest Jim Mars is going to be coming to San Francisco next month for a conference called International Inquiry into 9/11. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
All right, you're going to have to wait until we go to the break, and then we'll be right back with Jim, okay?
Okay.
Well, Jim, Ari wants to know about this conference you're going to be on.
Oh, yes, out in the San Francisco area.
Yes, right.
That's, I'm trying to look in my day timer here so I can get the correct date for you. I think it is...
yeah, it says March 26th to 28th.
Yes, I believe that's correct, yes. March 26th to 28th.
Uh-huh.
And it's going to be a citizens' inquiry into 9/11. And, yes, they've asked me if I'd come out there and speak to some of the people out there, and I'm really looking forward to that because I think far more than just a conference where you hear people stand up and make presentations, I think this is going to be more of a let's get our heads together and let's combine our information and let's see what we can put out. Now, this, I think, is the kind of thing that should be happening and should be taken notice of in a free and democratic society. But all of you that are listening to me right now, you keep watching your newspapers and you watch your major television networks over that weekend, and you let me know if there's even a blip of publicity about this. This is the severe control of the media in this country.
Okay, anything else, Ari?
No, that's it.
Okay, fine. Thanks very much.
Sure.
Of course, if I could just put in a plug, we have a video. I think it's really quite good. If you can stand listening to me talk for 2 hours and 20 minutes, called 9/11 Contrived. And it's really the background, the history, as it leads up, of course, to the attack on the World Trade Center. A lot of information in there you're not going to get elsewhere. But, of course, the book that we're talking about, The War on Freedom by Tex Mars, really is must reading. Tremendous amount of material in there that we really need to get the people to read and understand that they knew the attack was coming. And they did absolutely nothing to stop it. And that's really what's so frightening, that they told the people in the South Tower to stay at their position, and yet, of course, they knew another plane was coming. It was headed in. It had been hijacked. And yet the people were told not to evacuate the building. they were left there to die, in my estimation. And, of course, they even went so far as to lock the doors to the roof, because during the first bombing, the number of people escaped up on the roof and were taken off by helicopter. But that wasn't to be allowed this time. Their excuse was, well, we were afraid people might get up on the roof and commit suicide, so we locked the doors, and a lot of people ran to the roof thinking they could get out there and be rescued by helicopter, but there was to be no escape.
So they ended up jumping out broken windows anyway.
Right.
It's just unconscionable. Let me tell you, there is a 125-year-old fireman's publication called Fire Engineering, okay? And it is an industry publication. It goes to fire investigators and firemen all across the country.
Hold on just a moment here. Go ahead. Okay, fine. Go ahead, Jim.
Okay, so this is the fireman's in-house publication called Fire Engineering, and I just wanted to read you what the January 2, 2002 issue, their editor, fellow by the name of Bill Manning, said, Fire Engineering has good reason to believe that the official investigation blessed by FEMA and run by the American Society of Civil Engineers into the collapse of the World Trade Center is a, quote, half-baked farce that may already have been commandeered by political forces whose primary interests, to put it mildly, lie far afield of full disclosure. And in that same issue, there were representatives from various fire departments, including the New York Fire Department. And they were saying that this was just, you know, one of the biggest disasters in U.S. fire, and yet it was never investigated.
It never was. Well, Jim, we're out of time. Why don't you get your website out there just one more time?
Right. It's jimmarrs.com, JIMMARRS.com. And if you want to call and order a edition of Rule by Secrecy,
We actually carry that book.
That's right. You carry it there, or you can get it from my website, or I believe you can even get it off of Amazon.com and maybe even from major bookstores.
Well, we carry the book because we think it's important. God bless you. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. We'll be talking with you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, the time goes so quickly, but the information that Jim has, I think, is so vitally important. The book is The War on Freedom. Now, there are two books by that name. One is by a fellow named Rashid, I believe, an Arabic name. They're both excellent books, but I like Jim's better. If you'd like more information, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Or if you'd like to find out more about his other book, Rule by Secrecy, it goes into the secret societies. And there really are secret societies out there. There are many of them. And some people want to tell you it's all the Catholics, or some people will tell you it's all the Jews, or some people will tell you it's all the Masons. It is a menage of many, many forces working behind the scenes involved in this movement towards the New World Order, the New World Religion. Well, this is the time we just want to mention that, first of all, if you'd like to get in touch with us, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. And if you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like, of course, to go to our website at radioliberty.com. You can, of course, listen to our internet programs 5 hours a day. And then when you get tired of that, you can listen to our archive programs. So there's a great volume of material there. If there's anything that was said tonight that you'd like to have verified, we have the documentation on everything that I said, certainly. And I'm sure Jim Myers can back up what he has had to say. And you know how to reach his telephone number. So this is the time we hope that many of you will tell others about the program, encourage them to listen. Of course, this program is being heard on shortwave all throughout the world, 2 hours in the evening now. If you know anybody who has a shortwave set, encourage them to begin listening on a regular basis, and we'll try gradually to educate them about what's really going on behind the scenes. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and for our ministers. We ask you to pray for revival, because we are involved in a spiritual battle. And the secret societies are made up of people who are involved in really demonic activity. And this is what energizes the secret societies and the ancient mystery religions that have been here since the beginning of recorded time. And lastly, of course, we ask you to remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And so until we'll have to say goodbye to our listeners up in the Great Northwest. Of course, if you're listening on shortwave, why, we'll be with you another hour. And so until, as far as our listeners in the Northwest, until tomorrow evening, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But hold your calls for a few minutes. We have with us on the line Arthur Burnclough. We're going to be talking about the veterans and, of course, the way they're being treated by our government today. Now, the veterans Arthur is talking about, many of them are veterans of the Gulf War, the veterans of the second of the Vietnam and of Korea and the Second World War. But our veterans are very shabbily treated. We hear our leaders always talking about how we love our soldiers and how brave they are. But, of course, when they come home and they're disabled and they're badly injured and unable to provide for themselves, and now it is, especially with the victims of the Gulf War illness, where almost 400,000, some people say over 400,000, of the 690-some-thousand men we sent to the Gulf are ill, and they're dying, and, of course, nothing is being done for them, and they can't get treatment. And the government have done everything they could to discourage anybody who tried to come up with effective treatment for the terrible disease that they have. And it's, I should say diseases, because, of course, it's not one disease. It's related to the experimental drugs that they gave them, things like pyridostigma drug bromide, which interacted with the DEET, which is a pesticide that was impregnated in their uniforms. And a pyridostigma bromide is a drug that is given to people who are going to die. It's given to people with the myasthenia gravis, and they all die eventually. It's never been given to normal people. No justification at all for giving it to people who might possibly be attacked with chemical weapons. But, of course, we did that just the same. And then they gave them experimental vaccines, and they had things in those vaccines. We know that there are experimental things there because there's squalene in the vaccines, and antibodies to squalene are the people who are the sickest are those who have many times the antibodies to squalene. And we know that they were injured by the depleted uranium and by the oil fires, the chemicals from the oil fires. And there were so many reasons these young men got ill. And when they went home, of course, they were forgotten. There's a wonderful video. It's called Thanks of a Grateful Nation. It has Ted Danson in it. If you have a chance and you want to really feel as strongly as I do, go to your Blockbuster, The Thanks of a Grateful Nation. It's the story of the boys who came home after the Gulf War and how they were treated, and the cover-up that took place to cover up the chemical contamination. Now, there was certainly a bacteriological contamination or viral or maybe mycoplasm contamination, because we know of the other very sick veterans, why 40% of their wives contracted the same disease. So that was probably mycoplasm infection that they got from their husbands. Then they got the mycoplasm, of course, from the vaccines. So there's so much you're not getting, and you want to verify what I just said. Of course, it's covered in the Rockefeller Committee report. Came out of the Veterans Administration in 1994. We make that available here at Radio Liberty. The U.S. Publishing Office printed 35 for the entire nation, 35 copies of this report, other than what they provided to the members of the committee. And I bought up 25 of them. I asked them why they didn't print thousands of them. They said, oh, they're so expensive. Well, we actually run them off on our copy machine. The Rockefeller Committee report that tells you how the wives got sick and all the things that were done to our boys, not only there, but other experiments that were done. Well, we'll be back in just a moment here, and we'll introduce our special guest for this evening, Arthur Birnbaum, who represents veterans trying to get what is justifiably theirs from a Veterans Administration that is more concerned with fiscal restraints than with compassion. Arthur, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Hello, Dr. Spann. How are you today?
I'm doing just fine. Why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners? Because, of course, we have not only our listeners here in the Monterey Bay area and our listeners on the Internet, but now we have listeners across America, really across the world, on our shortwave international hookup. So go ahead.
Well, we should be getting the military shortwave, our troops stationed overseas, and a lot of this is geared at them because someday they're going to be veterans also, and these are things that they should be privy to. They should know what's going on. And I heard what you were talking about before with with the sickness that most of the Gulf veterans have come back with, and we had a biological weapon called Mycoplasma incognitus fermentis,
right.
And 4 years prior to the Gulf War I breaking out, we gave this weapon to Saddam, who was considered our ally at the time, and directed him to use it against the Iranians, and he finished his war off in 2 days by killing several thousand Iranians with a gas made from this. And 4 years later, our troops came into the area, and we were hit with a watered-down version of that gas. It was in the Scud missiles. And this is one of the things that, one of the reasons that a lot of people have come back with sickness. This is one of the sicknesses that we've come back with from the Gulf area. And it's a sickness of our own making. It's our own weapon.
Well, that's what's really, really interesting, of course, is that Germans were working this during the Second World War, and many of those German scientists were brought, and they were Nazi war criminals, of course, but they were brought to America secretly under something known as Operation Paperclip.
That's right.
At least according to Dr. Garth Nicholson, were allowed to continue working on these biological warfare agents here in the United States, and they actually modified, they created new organisms, this mycoplasm incognitus fermentans, or fermentans incognitus, I can never remember which it is. It seems to be, or it appears to be, a biologically altered disease because it has on its shell or on its membrane actually one of the molecules that you find on the HIV virus. So, but that's an entirely different story, but this is a biological warfare agent, and I was not aware of the fact we'd actually given that to Saddam.
Well, there's a lady, an author in Washington by the name of Linda Hunt, who put out a book called Secret Agenda, and that will tell you in detail of all that Operation Paperclip is all about. It's quite a book that she's put out.
Well, I'll tell you, trying to get a copy of that today is like pulling a hen's teeth. We got, actually, one of our listeners up in the Great Northwest was kind enough to buy that. Cost about $125 or $130.
Yeah.
She got a copy, and of course we have it in our library. We treasure that. But other copies were $300-$400.
It's I know, St. Martin's Press.
In other words, the CIA or somebody's buying them all up, because the last thing they want the American people to know about is Operation Paperclip, where we not only brought the Nazi war criminals to America, people like Wernher von Braun and
yep.
the people who worked
exactly.
on Operation Bluebird psychologically, and then the biological of warfare agents, but we actually helped the Nazis, war criminals, escape to South America. And that's really that's the last thing that we ever want the American people to know, that we protected Martin Bormann and Klaus Barbie and Mengele and Eichmann and all the other Nazis that we helped to escape to South America. And you might ask why. But if you have to understand, there is a bond between those people within the Brotherhood of Death, within these occult, secret occult societies.
Yes.
What motivated the Nazis was occultism. What motivated our intelligence agencies were the same occult organization.
And if you think that book is hard to pick up, try a book called The Plot to Seize the White House by Jules Archer.
Oh, that's the story of General Smedley Butler, isn't it?
Correct. They've taken that out of all the libraries, out of all the bookstores. You can't even get a copy in a library.
Sure. Well, of course, yeah. The most important thing is not to let the American people learn the truth, but you flood them with all these books that really don't say much of anything.
No. I know. I paid over $200 for that book myself.
Well, if I can't get a copy, maybe I can get you to copy it for me and send me the pages.
I'll be glad to.
Go ahead.
Okay. What I'm going to talk about this evening is the Veterans Administration. My name is Arthur Bernclough, and I'm the Executive Director of Veterans for Constitutional Law, and we're a veterans advocacy group. What I mean by a veterans advocacy group, we're not like the Disabled American Veterans, the American Legion, the Veterans for Foreign Wars. We help the veterans. We lobby for the veterans, and we don't lobby for the Veterans Administration like all the others do. There's a difference between them and us. They are chartered. We refuse a charter. We don't want to be chartered, because if we're chartered, we have to take the orders from Mother VA. And we don't like to take the orders from Mother VA, because as far as we're concerned, they're the enemy. And we're located at 112 Jefferson Avenue in Port Jefferson, New York. And our zip code is 11777. And we fight some of the outrages that the VA is pulling with veterans, and we found that they're not the only enemy, because the service organizations are sworn to uphold the VA and not the veterans. The Justice Department, they represent the VA in any litigation, whether right or wrong, and they're usually wrong. And, of course, the Defense Department. And we're going to focus on one particular group here tonight. We're going to focus on the service organizations, which we started to talk about on December 30th, and the program came to an end, and I said we'd be back and we'd talk about it. Now, we're going to talk particularly about, well, all of the chartered groups, but in particular the Disabled American Veterans. And it's something that's floating around the internet. It's an article by David Vest, and it says, "Wounded Held Captive at Walter Reed. Disabled Vets Fire Back at Rumsfeld." Now, you're going to hear this, and you're going to say, this can't be. And you're going to be right. It can't be. It's fabricated. It's a fraud. And here's the way it goes. The organization known as Disabled American Veterans has been helping U.S. combat casualties figure out what benefits they have coming to them and how to apply for them since 1920. Lately, the Bush administration has been going out of its way to make the DAV's job harder. Their job would be hard enough even if the government appreciated their efforts and was glad to see them coming. Incredibly, it doesn't and it isn't. Not anymore. An army of U.S. veterans more than twice the size of Operation Iraqi Freedom have lost their health insurance benefits since Bush took office. As many as 500,000 vets are homeless. 7 VA hospitals are being closed as part of an effort to restructure the Department of Veterans Affairs, that's the VA. Meanwhile, veterans of the Iraq campaign can fall in line with over 250,000 U.S. veterans who are already waiting at least 6 months to see a doctor. This part is true. Although it hasn't hesitated to send them to face death in Iraq, the administration has consistently opposed any attempt to extend full benefits to reservists and National Guardsmen, 20% of whom have no health insurance by General Accounting Office estimates. This is true. It was one thing when the White House tried to roll back increases in monthly imminent danger pay and family separation allowance, and another when it called a modest proposal to increase the sum given to families of soldiers who die on active duty wasteful and unnecessary. Finally, it occurred to the firm of Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld to wonder how much money the country would save and how much more could be diverted to Bechtel and Halliburton contracts if veterans couldn't even find out what their benefits are. That part is true. And so now we learn that ever since Operation Iraqi Freedom got underway, it's been easier for a terrorist to get into the United States legally than for a DAV representative to get into a military hospital to help wounded soldiers with their benefit applications. Sickeningly, the Pentagon has been severely limiting DAV access to wounded veterans and doing it on the grounds of security. And, oh yes, protecting privacy. This is a fabrication. It's a contrived story. It protects the veterans' policy by not allowing them to speak with DAV representatives unmonitored. Fortunately, somebody blinked, and it wasn't the disabled American veterans. When he got back to the office after celebrating New Year's Eve and opened his mail, Donald Rumsfeld found a letter informing him that he had messed with the wrong people this time, and here's part of what DAV, Washington Headquarters Executive Director David Gorman, had to say to the Secretary of Defense. At one facility in particular, Walter Reed Army Medical Center, our efforts to visit with wounded patients have been severely restricted. For example, all requests to visit patients must now be made through the WRAMC headquarters office, which then selects the patients we may visit and strictly limits information about the patients, and even the patient's name and the nature of the injury is withheld without express permission. The DAV's representatives are also escorted at all times while in the facility, and all contact with patients is closely monitored by the escort. This is particularly unnerving and inappropriate, as all conversations between a representative and client are confidential in nature. I believe these overly broad restrictions on patient access inhibit the ability of our professional accredited representatives to help ensure these wounded service members have the vital information they and their families need in order to obtain the medical care and benefits many of these veterans will depend upon for decades to come. Now, don't you believe for one minute that the DAV cares what happens to these veterans. They care about one thing, the freebies that they're going to get from the VA. And that's it. Now, the American public would be outraged if these restrictions became public knowledge. Would they? Hard to tell. There's been little or no coverage in the mainstream media since the DAV released the letter. Sure, there's been little or no coverage. They know it's a fraud. Gorman goes on to say, the record of benefits awarded by the VA shows our honored wounded and injured are getting less than they rightfully entitled. That's true. Those wounded and disabled in service to our nation should not be held captive and deprived of the knowledge that would allow them to receive their rightful benefits earned on a battlefield half a world away. It brings great dishonor to our nation to learn of disabled veterans suffering physical and economic hardships following their release from medical treatment solely because they're unaware and uninformed of their rightful benefits. Think of it. Wounded veterans held captive, prevented from seeing people who have a congressional charter to serve them, not allowed to speak with DAV reps in private, lest their privacy be violated, an administration that regards disabled American veterans as security risks. A government increasingly unable to tell the difference between terrorists and its own citizens. Now, here's the real story. There's a membership drive going on for the DAV, for their sagging membership, and this is the government's way of helping the DAV get some publicity and helping their membership drive.
Well, now, certainly, Arthur, much of what was in that letter seemed very, very straightforward and probably very accurate, wasn't it?
Some of it, yes. Some of it was. But these people are not prevented from seeing these, veterans and service members in the hospitals. They are definitely not prevented from doing this.
So that wasn't true, what you're suggesting?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely it's not true. And this was sent to me by Wind Bear, Steve Mungie, Divide, Colorado. Now, I had answered Steve Mungie. There, Steve, I've been alerted to the fraud in David Vest's letter several days ago. First of all, you cannot believe any statements coming out of the Disabled American Veterans Organization. And don't forget that these are the very same people who go running up on the psychiatric wards in the VA hospitals to sign up patients for their lifetime memberships, who many times are not mentally nor emotionally capable of making decisions. This is a very disturbing policy of the DAV, which they have refused to address whenever they've been confronted about it. Now, for many years, the DAV, as well as the other chartered National Veterans Service organizations, have been the VA's very own private support groups. Not the injured veterans, mind you, but the VA's. Membership in all these backbiting groups have been dropping drastically due to the veterans communities becoming privy to the news that they are not on the veterans' side, but on the VA's. This entire scenario is contrived by the DAV with government cooperation to hype up a membership drive. Mr. Gorman, executive director of the DAV, and his deputy, Mr. Rick Sewerat, pronounced Sewerat, in defense of the United States Code Title 38, 511A, the statute which Congress protects, giving the Secretary of the VA finality in any decision concerning veterans' benefits, and United States Code Title 38, Section 5904, which denies veteran claimants the right to have their own attorneys, they state equivocally that if these outrageous laws were removed, the VA would not be able to deliver their health care nor their benefits to the disabled veterans of this nation.
Well, I'm sure what they're saying is that it would cost so much money to take care of the veterans that there wouldn't be any money left over for health care. Is that what they're saying?
Well, there wouldn't be any money left over for them. What they're saying is if they took away these laws, the one that refuses to have a veteran have their own attorney and refuses to let veterans go into a real court, if they took away these laws, that means the VA would not be able to deliver their health care system or their benefits to the disabled veterans of this nation.
But it seems to me that they're doing everything they cut back on offering the health care to the disabled American veterans. And, of course, when the veterans, have been promised that they would always have access to health care.
Exactly.
Now, of course, they're withdrawing that. In other words, they just sort of like, we changed our minds. Sorry, fellas, you fought and bled and suffered, and a lot of you died, but we're not going to keep up the promise that we made.
And they also say, if these laws were so bad, Congress would have gotten rid of them years ago. Now, how can Congress get rid of them when the DAV, the American Legion, the VFW, and all the others lobby Congress 24 hours a day? They walk the halls of Congress day and night, lobbying Congress, you better not get rid of these laws. This is what protects us and the VA. Now, all of this, what they're saying, it's unmitigated twaddle. And I'm saying to them, tell me another one, boys. Now, in the interim, they don't utter one word about the United States Code Section 5902, the gravy train statute that gives them all these freebies. They also don't say another word about the VA Secretary Anthony Principi, who is a major player in the QTC Corporation of Diamond Bar, California, which is under indictment in the state of California for insurance fraud and has had their contract with the VA for physical evaluations more than quadrupled since Principi took charge of the VA, and they are also, by the way, under investigation by the Railroad Retirement Board. And, Dr. Stan, do you smell a conflict of interest here?
Well, I think that for our listeners have to understand that basically all these veterans organizations are being funded by the Veterans Administration.
Exactly.
And, of course, remember, who pays the piper calls the tune. So the Veterans Administration, rather than championing the rights of the veterans, are simply doing everything they can to curry favor with the people who are paying them. That is the Veterans Administration. And the Veterans Administration does this because they don't want the veterans to have any representation, and there are laws that are in place that the veterans really is not able effectively to present a legal case. He's not able to go before a court. He goes before a kangaroo court.
Exactly.
He wants his disability, and of course, then they delay him, and they delay him, and they delay him. He's not allowed to have legal representation.
Exactly.
And what will it take you, 7 to 10 years before you can get to the point where you can actually get a fair hearing?
Yeah, nobody will have any kind of fair representation or get any kind of a fair hearing or be allowed to have their own attorney until they get a final decision from the Board of Veterans' Appeals. And that never takes less than 7 years. Now, the entire VA situation, including the DAV and the rest of the chartered National Veterans Service organizations, including their friends in the House Veterans Affairs Committee and the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, are out of control, bringing the real truth about the VA system and its government cohorts to the American public is really the only way that we can do anything about it and give America's veterans legal parity with the rest of our nation. And I'm saying to everybody, do not be fooled by the DAVs and the government smokescreen. This is just another way for them to boost the sagging membership of the DAV and other service organizations. Remember, the National Veteran Service Organizations, they are definitely not the lobby for America's veterans, but they are most definitely the VA's lobby.
Hold that thought right there, Arthur.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening of Arthur Bernclough. And, of course, he is a advocate for the American veterans who are not getting a fair shape. And you really must understand the attitude of the elitists towards our veterans. I think it was best said by Henry Kissinger, and you'll find the quotation in Woodward and Bernstein's book, The Final Days, page 194. And Henry Kissinger said of our veterans, the military is made up of stupid, dumb animals who should be used for foreign policy activities. Stupid, dumb veterans, these are the boys, idealistic young boys, who are willing to risk their lives and go overseas to fight for America for people like Henry Kissinger. And he thinks they're stupid, dumb animals. And the fact you never hear that quoted, of course, is because the last thing they want is for our military to understand how the elite really looks upon them. And I would say that it's about time the veterans and every American was incensed by the mistreatment of our men, sending them overseas to fight in futile wars that had not fought to defend America, but to pursue this international dream of a new world order, a new world religion. And, of course, that's exactly what the war in Iraq is. It has nothing to do with the wicked Saddam Hussein, because he used to work for the American CIA. If you don't believe that, the book on Holy Babylon, written a decade ago, pointed out that in 1955, Saddam Hussein was a CIA agent. We helped him to power in 1979. We financed him all during the 1980s. We financed him after the Gulf War. You need to read the book, See No Evil by Robert Baer, pointing out that repeatedly the military on two separate occasions in Iraq tried to overthrow Saddam Hussein, notified Americans what was going to happen each time. Our State Department betrayed these men. Their military officers were arrested, tortured, and killed. We allowed Saddam Hussein to continue smuggling oil out through both Jordan and Turkey. We could have stopped it at any time. But you see, Saddam needed that money from the smuggling to pay the Republican guard, to pay his bodyguards, and to pay off his cronies. So we financed Saddam Hussein, and now, of course, we went to war with Saddam Hussein, and now we've captured the wicked Saddam Hussein. And who has he been turned over to? Why, to the CIA that he worked for so many years. What's wrong with this picture? Well, maybe, of course, our boys are being asked to fight and die for reasons far different than the average American will ever know. Pick up the story from there, Arthur.
Okay. Another article just appeared here in the newspaper. It's a news release for immediate release, January 7th, 2004. Daschle appoints decorated veterans to Disability Benefits Commission, Washington, D.C. Senator Tom Daschle, the minority Senate leader, today appointed two decorated veterans to the Veterans Disability Benefits Commission, created in the fiscal year 2004 Defense Authorization Act. The commission will review benefits paid to veterans who are disabled or killed while serving in the military. Daschle appointed former Nevada Governor Mike O'Callaghan and Rick Surratt, pronounced Surratt, to join the commission. A recipient of the Purple Heart, Bronze Star, and Silver Star, O'Callaghan served in the Marine Corps as an intelligence operator in the Air Force and as an Army infantryman during the Korean War. O'Callaghan was governor of Nevada from 1971 to 1978. Now, we have no objection to O'Callaghan. He's got the credentials anyway. Rex Surratt is the Deputy National Legislative Director of the Disabled American Veterans. Surratt served in the U.S. Army in Vietnam and was wounded in combat in 1967. He is a life member of DAV Chapter 14 in Salem, Virginia. I'm pleased to appoint Governor O'Callaghan and Mr. Surratt to this important commission, said Senator Daschle. These two individuals have consistently demonstrated their commitment to our nation's veterans, and I know they'll be strong and effective advocates for the brave men and women who have served our country. Okay. Here's an article that, an answer to this, and it's an article that's going to appear, a very short article that I wrote here. It's going to appear in Parade magazine and also in Eclipse. And it's called Another Lobby Fox Enters the Hen House and Other National Veteran Service Organization Chicanery. In reference to an article floating around the internet by David Vest called Wounded Held Captive at Walter Reed or Disabled Vets Fire Back at Rumsfeld, believe me, I am the last person to defend Rumsfeld, Bush, Cheney, and the rest of the bunch who have attempted to deceive America and now have us mired in a war which has cost us at least 500 Americans killed in action.
And don't forget about the 400 we lost over in Afghanistan. In
addition, yeah. Right? Now, how much is oil worth?
Well,
how
whatever we're there for, the question is it really worth it? Did we have a right to go over there to contaminate that whole country with depleted uranium
nope.
to risk the lives and health of our soldiers for this imperialistic dream of the people, not George Bush, but the men who surround him? We're going to be back here in just a moment with Arthur Burnclough. Welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Arthur Burnclough. Somebody had called in and wanted to repeat the title of the books and the movie. What movie were you talking about specifically? Or was this from the last hour? The last hour I was talking about a book, a movie titled The Thanks of a Grateful Nation.
Yes.
The books I was talking about were Unholy Babylon, which is the story of Saddam Hussein and the CIA. And if anybody wants, of course, material on that, they can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. The book See No Evil by Robert Baer, who was the senior CIA agent in Iraq in 1995. He was up in Kurdistan, but he, of course, writes about how we allowed Saddam to smuggle oil, and how the Iraqis believed, as he said, every Iraqi he believed that the American government was keeping Saddam Hussein in power, and many of them believed that Saddam was a CIA agent. You'll actually find that in one of my newsletters. If you go through our newsletters about 3 or 4 months ago, we go into that in some detail. And then, of course, how repeatedly the military tried to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and of course, we each time betrayed them. That book, again, See No Evil by Robert Baer, B-A-E-R. Well, right now we've got Arlene calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Arlene. Did you have a question or comment on this subject?
Yes. I'm the mother of a Vietnam vet, disabled, who died the day before a pulmonary exam he was to have waited for over 6 months to get. He died of a cardiopulmonary arrest.
Right.
Now, the reason why I'm calling is that he was a life member of the DAV.
Oh.
And through the DAV, I was able to get him 100% disability, because most of the vets, when they come out of the wars, only get 30% disability. And unless somebody goes to bat for them, they don't get the 100% disability.
So DAV did go to bat for him?
Yes, they did.
It does happen occasionally, sure.
Also, I had to help along. I had to write a lot of letters to the Veterans Administration, and I had to send documents and all kinds of things. But they did go to bat for him, and I'm finding what you're saying, you know, I realize that, you know, the whole system has really been undermined, because My son never had to wait that long for tests that he requested.
Young lady, would you believe that only 4% of the veterans who apply actually get paid? 96% are turned down.
I can believe that.
Okay, let's go ahead. Did you have anything else you want to say, Arlene?
No, that's all. Thank you.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
Bye.
And I think that I know that I've come in contact with some people who work for Veterans Administration, pardon me, for these organizations. It was Disabled American Veterans. I think that was the one. Veterans. Well, I've forgotten. Let's see. The big organizations, the American Legion. What's the number two organization?
Well, the number one organization in size is the DAV, Disabled American Veterans, and the number two is the American Legion.
All right. Well, there was another one, of course.
Veterans of Foreign Wars.
Veterans of Foreign Wars. That's the one. And, of course, I talked to the gentleman there about the Gulf War illness, and he was right on and really was doing a great job of getting the information out. Very soon, he got fired, and the next man came in and said, there is no Gulf War syndrome.
I'll bet he was in the Bottle Post. In Santa Cruz.
No, he wasn't, as a matter of fact. No,
okay,
this was
they're good. I know those people. They're very good people.
Yeah, this was a fellow back in Washington, D.C. What really disturbed me was they got rid of a good man and they brought in a turkey.
That's what they do.
And, of course, I'm just so glad that Arlene's son did get good treatment. But I think the figure you use, only 4% really do get the money.
That's right.
I think that is a frightening figure to contemplate.
We call it the VA's 4% solution. Now, we were saying before, how much is oil worth? Now, while there's people war profiteering and there's no end in sight, people are there, they're war profiteering, there is no end in sight, and Congress has approved $87 billion more to throw into the Iraqi quicksand. And this complete fabrication by the DAV and all its cohorts, this should really be exposed for the fraud that it is. And the DAV is claiming that the Department of Defense is picking on them by not allowing their representatives to go up on the floors of the hospital unescorted. And we take a very careful look at this situation. I've researched this very carefully. I've talked to dozens and dozens of people who are involved in this. Now, first of all, as I said before, the DAV has been criticized in the past for going up on the psychiatric floors in the VA hospital to sign up patients for their expensive lifetime memberships, who many times are not mentally nor emotionally capable of making decisions. And it's a very disturbing policy of the DAV, which they've refused to address whenever they've been confronted about it. And some veterans' families have complained about the DAV hawking mental patients and critically sick terminal patients prior to dying. In fact, one man was hawked 2 hours before dying and bought a lifetime membership, and the family was complaining about it.
Well, of course, Arlene had a different impression of DAV, but I'm sure that there can certainly be excesses at times.
She's one of a minority they did something for, and it's a rare thing that they do something.
No, my concern is that I don't think the veterans right now are getting a good return. And, of course, I think it's becoming even much, much worse for the veterans coming back from this war. I mean, it's always been bad once they get back and they try to get things out of the VA.
Yeah.
The level of care in the veterans in hospitals is going progressively down. At one time, they were really pretty good hospitals.
At one time, they were excellent hospitals.
They're cutting back and they're cutting back and funding, and they're closing down the hospitals. And then to get an appointment sometimes just takes an awful long time.
At the time of World War II, they were excellent hospitals. Even at the beginning of the Korean War, it was at excellent hospitals. And then they went all the way downhill. Now, we said before, coincidentally, there happens to be a big membership drive going on currently to booster up a sagging membership. Since veterans have become privy to the fact that the DAV and other veterans organizations effectively lobby against judicial review of VA decisions and also fight against the right for veterans to have their own attorneys. Now, that section of law is called 5904, and, you know, there was somebody by the name of Abraham Lincoln who said, you can fool some of the people all of the time, all of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all of the people all of the time. and that was Abraham Lincoln back in 1961.
I think it was probably a little before
1861.
I'm sorry. That's all right. I do the same thing.
Now, another bit of outrageous news, what I just read before, the minority leader of the Senate, Tom Daschle, has appointed Rick Sewerat as the Deputy National Legislative Director of the DAV to serve on the new Veterans Disability Benefits Commission, created in the year 2004 Defense Authorization Act. Now, he also appointed Nevada Governor Michael O'Callaghan, a recipient of the Purple Heart, Bronze Star, Silver Star, and we certainly, of course, have no objection to O'Callaghan. He has the credentials. However, Surratt is another story. In a letter to James Beeler of the Missouri Veterans Project, Surratt stated in a long-winded diatribe, and I have that letter here with me now, that if Section 511A of USC Title 38 were repealed, that the VA would no longer have the authority to provide benefits to veterans, and there would be no decisions for the appellate courts to review. Benefits for veterans would cease because there would be no delivery system. This is an example of the BS and twaddle being fed to veterans by the DAV and some of the other chartered service organizations. Now, in that same letter, he goes on to defend 5902, the gravy train statute, which is costing American taxpayers millions upon millions of dollars payoff money for each chartered service organization, which should be used directly to help disabled veterans rather than the freeloaders.
Now, why don't you explain what this involves? Because there is a subsidy to the Veterans Veterans Organizations by the Veterans Administration. So you call it the gravy train status. What is it involved? How much funding do these people get?
Okay.
The use of their organization.
Good point, Dr. Stan. This section 5902, it reads, the National Veterans Service Organizations, the chartered National Veterans Service Organizations, may receive free rent in any VA building, whether it be a hospital or a VA office building. Rent free, and that's all it says. That's all it says. But when they give it a liberal interpretation, it also gives them heating, electricity, air conditioning, all free, free furniture, free computer equipment, free postage, free telephone, free stationery,
but of course
staff to run the office.
But there's no salaries paid. It's just all the facilities that they work in would be free.
Oh, they provide a staff to run the office, too.
I mean, they actually give money for a staff?
Sure. They give them a staff to run the office and, of course, a tax-exempt status. Now, if you get an honest financial statement from any of these veterans organizations, they could put some of our largest corporations to shame because these people have got money like you wouldn't believe. Now, in that same letter, he goes on to say Section 5902A is the VA's legal authority to recognize service organization employees as veterans representatives. The United States, just as that's VA's authority, United States Code Section 5904, that's the one that denies attorneys for veterans, is also the VA's legal authority to recognize attorneys and agents for that purpose. If 5904 were repealed, now get this convoluted reasoning. If 5904 were repealed, as you suggest, the VA would be without authority to authorize attorneys to handle veterans' claims. We are opposed to veterans' benefits being diverted into the pockets of attorneys. Dr. Stan, what incredible, unmitigated twaddle.
Now, basically what they're saying is that they don't want the veterans to be able to hire an attorney to represent themselves going up against the Veterans Administration.
Exactly. Now, the bottom line is, this man who has just been appointed by Mr. Daschle, and a veteran knows now, he can't get any more out of the Democrats than he did out of the Republicans, because one is exactly the same as the other. When we talk about the Democrats and the Republicans, we talk about Tweedledee and Tweedledum. And that's the bottom line. This man has never been an advocate or a lobbyist for veterans. an advocate and a lobbyist for the VA. Oh, you bet, he certainly is, but not for veterans. And if Senator Tom Daschle can appoint a lobby fox to a sensitive position like this, then veterans and military retirees will fare no better with the Democrats than they had with the Republicans. And common sense tells us that it's past due time to look for a good, viable third-party candidate for those of us who have served our nation with pride. And Mr. Surratt got an answer from me. He got a letter, and it started off a whole series of letters between him and myself. And my letter to him was, Dear Mr. Surratt, this letter was forwarded to us by one of our members in Missouri, a former member of your organization, disillusioned with good reason by the poor quality of the representation of your service officers on his benefits claims. Mr. James Beeler, like a multitude of other veterans that we know, won their claim, and I cleared this with Mr. James Beeler before I decided to read this tonight. He says, by all means, read the letter, and the more people that know about this, the better. Like a multitude of other veterans we know, won their claims very quickly after dumping the DAV's representation in favor of real attorneys. We got them real attorneys who took this into court on constitutional grounds. Now, this is not just an isolated incident. I keep receiving complaints from veterans throughout the nation in reference to the way the DAV and other service organizations were handling their claims, causing veterans with very viable claims to walk the corridors of time for 20, 30, and even 40 years or more, not knowing why their claims continue to be denied. Mr. Beeler's perfect answer to you in his September 24th letter cut right to the quick, despite all of your circumnavigating. In your letters to him, you may want to discuss the derivation of this new word, circumnavigating, with Mr. William Sapphire, columnist of the New York Times, who is a master of the King's English and knows your VA quite well. In reading the encircled twaddle of your letter to Mr. Beeler, we now understand fully the symbiotic relationship the DAV has with the VA, and now so completely merge the two organizations together that they are as one. When a veteran comes to us and presents proof of less than adequate VA claims representation by the service organization, we advise them to, number one, get the millstone out from around your neck and stop walking in the enemy camp. If you're serious about your claim, get rid of the DAV and service organization quasi-lawyers and their symbiotic relationships with the VA. Retain your own power of attorney until you find one capable of doing something constructive for you. And send your notice by registered mail to both the DAV and the VA. Once you're rid of the clowns, we might talk, and this is a 30-year education of veterans' claims in one short letter. No charge. The next move is yours.
All right.
Now, we have a phenomenal rate, Dr. Stan, of success in finding the right attorneys and paralegals to handle and win cases that have been bungled by the service organizations, and the handwriting is on the wall. I hope that you can see it. We're not even going to try to buck your lobby with Congress. We're going to let the media put Congress's feet to the fire. And if you're reading the newspapers and magazines and listening to the radio and TV, your friends at the VA and even yourselves are starting to get well known to the media, and I don't think they or the American people like what they see. The illusion has disappeared. The fun and games will soon be over. And then we can really get down to business in real courts, and I don't mean the U.S. Court of Appeals for veterans' claims. We're talking about real Article III federal courts that will use their fine and imprisonment powers to compel the VA and its attorneys to obey the letter of the law and put an end to all these charades. And I would very strongly advise any legal unqualified service organization to get out of the law business before this whole thing hits the fan. Yours very truly, Arthur N. Burnclough, Executive Director.
Well, Arthur, before running out of time, would you like to get your address and your telephone number out there? So if there are people there who are bound down or in this quagmire of appeals in the Veterans Administration, and for our listeners, the whole idea is to keep putting people off and off and off, because if you delay it a year, why, you save a year's disability payments. And so you delay and delay and delay, because there's only a certain limited amount of money that's there, and they're going to do everything they can, doesn't matter how much it costs, not to give the veterans their benefits. Now, once in a while, somebody like Arlene's son will do very, very well. But I know this is sort of a game that is played. The whole idea is withhold the benefits as long as you can. What about your address? What about your telephone number?
Okay, we're Veterans for Constitutional Law, and we exist on donations, and everyone who works together with Veterans for Constitutional Law, nobody here draws a salary. In fact, most of us are putting in the money to keep Veterans for Constitutional Law going. Oh. We're paying Veterans for Constitutional Law. We're located, the full name of our organization is Veterans for Constitutional Law, comma, limited, LTD, period. And we're located at 112 Jefferson Avenue, 112 Jefferson Avenue, and that's in Port Jefferson, New York, Port Jefferson, New York. Zip code is 11777. If you want an easy way to remember it, 11777. Two aces and three sevens, a full house. And our telephone number is 631-474-4261, and we're always available to answer any of your calls. If nobody gets back to you within a day or two, figure we're in Washington, D.C. on business, but we will get back to you by the third day for sure. Again, we're Veterans for Constitutional Law, and our number is 631-474-4261. By the way, aside from that letter to Rick Surratt to introduce myself, I also sent a newspaper article from the New York Times, which said, Yugoslav upstart steals the spotlight. It's an article on Slobodan Milosevic, the president who they got rid of there, who, very strangely enough, is the spitting image of Archie Bunker of All in the Family. You remember him, Dr. Sam?
Oh, yes, and you're absolutely right. There is a similarity.
Oh, my God. And I drew a little blurb here of him saying, Rick Surratt, you're a meathead. So,
well, it doesn't really good, though, to call people's names, does it, really?
I know, but he got the message. He got the message, Dr. Stan. He really got the message. It started off a series of letters between him and myself, and sometime I'll read them to you personally. They're really quite funny.
All right, fine. Well, I want to. We're going to have to take a quick break here, and then we'll let you sort of wrap up your thoughts as far as the Veterans Administration. But we've seen this certainly with the government's handling of the Indians and their lands. The government has stolen literally hundreds of billions of dollars from the Indians. The Department of Indian Affairs said, well, the Indians are too stupid to manage their own affairs, so we'll look after them. We'll collect the money from the oil and gas on their land, and then we'll give it back to them. And you know what happened? They collected the money, but they wouldn't give it back. There were actually suits have been brought. Judges have ordered that the records be turned over, and they just refused to do it.
And I'll tell you, you picked the perfect similarity between the VA and the American Indians right there.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest has been Arthur Bernclough, and we're just pointing out the way that the government has treated the Indians. They've stolen their money, and because the Indians do not have adequate legal representation, this has been going on. The Indians live impoverished, and the Department of Indian Affairs, I don't know what they've done, with the literally hundreds of billions of dollars that they've stolen from the Indians. And when the judges say, you turn those records over immediately, why, they just simply laugh at them.
Yep.
Because they've got the backing of government. And it reminds me, of course, what Thomas Paine said. He said, all societies are good, but government, even at its best, is a necessary evil. So why don't you sort of wrap up your thoughts on what's going on for this evening, Arthur. Go ahead.
Okay, there's an old saying in Washington, D.C., garbage always floats to the top. And it usually happens that way. Now, we had an article that we did on the Washington Times Insight magazine, and immediately we got the head of the VFW sending in a letter to the Washington Times, ripping them for that article and ripping me for my comments in the article. Where is this man today who wrote it? I answered him. I answered his letter, and I think I answered it quite well. But this man today is an Assistant Secretary of Labor, another lobby fox who got into another position.
Well, of course, if you go along in government, well, you'll get just promoted up to get a key position, and then you get a good retirement. But you have to betray your principles. You have to betray your soul to do it, because, of course, there is no compassion. There's no concern, really, on the part of the officials for the veterans. The whole idea is we've got a certain amount of money. That's all we've got. We've got to delay and delay and delay, with the hope, of course, that there'll be a new appropriation next year. But if we don't have the money, we can't give it out. There's some veterans who are trying to take advantage. I don't think the majority are. And increasingly, I think that they're being mistreated. So let's get your final point here. Would you like to?
Well, yes. What I'm saying is, in view of what's happened with this appointment, and it seems like all the lobby foxes get appointed to these things, and it doesn't make any difference whether it's a Democrat or a Republican. What I'm trying to say is it's Tweedledee or Tweedledum, and the American public has got to reach a point of maturity when they vote for the candidate on the merits of the candidate and not on saying, I'm going to vote for this man because he's the lesser of two evils.
Well, I'm tired of voting for evil. I think it's time we had a good candidate running.
Exactly.
We have one running, and I'm going to be backing him. Anyway, thanks so very much for being with us, Arthur Burnclough. We'll look forward to talking to you again in the near future.
And thank you very much, Dr. Sam, for giving us a chance.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And those of you who are listening to our program for the first time here on Nationwide Shortwave, we want to introduce ourselves. I'm a retired orthopedic surgeon. I've been studying what's going on in the world since 1962. What's that? 42 years? It's by far the majority of my life. We have a pretty good grasp of what's going on, and it's simply that there is a lot of corruption, but behind that, there really are spiritual forces. We're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological battlefield. Why are some people unconcerned about the veterans, the plight of the veterans? Others are unconcerned about the plight of the Indians or other minority groups here in America. Why? It's really very, very simple. They're evil and wicked people. And when you understand that, of course, then things begin to make a lot more sense. Now, it's very difficult to put things into perspective. Unless you go into history, unless you go back through the centuries, through the millennia, to the ancient mystery religions and secret societies, and people say, what are you even talking about? Well, I suggest if you are a little puzzled by what I'm saying, you really need to seriously consider getting my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, or the video by the same name, although I think the book will give you more in the way of information about the secret societies and the secret that has been passed down by the sages of the mystery religions from generation to generation, from millennia to millennia, going back almost 6,000 years. And we actually reveal what that secret is in my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. And if you'd like more information, well, you can always give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We hope that, of course, many of you will want to get copies of our newsletter. Our December newsletter explains why the Supreme Court took God and prayer out of our schools. Everybody knows that they took God and prayer out of our schools, but nobody will tell you why. Well, you'll find that in my December newsletter. If you'd like a free copy of that, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We hope you'll go to our website at radioliberty.com, and you can pull down all of our back newsletters going back to the mid-1990s. You can listen to our internet programs 5 hours a day, and then when you get tired of that, you can listen to the archive programs. Read some of the things we've written about the population control agenda, the material up there from Barrett Schoes on the signs and symbols that are used by the occult that you see every day. That's Barrett Schoes' section on the Radio Liberty newsletter at radioliberty.com. And then, of course, we hope that you'll tell others about our internet programs. We hope that you'll tell them about our website. We hope that you'll tell them about our shortwave, because we have the opportunity now to reach people 4 hours a day on shortwave, bringing you the information you can't get elsewhere, and we just need to get people with a shortwave set listening on a regular basis as we begin to re-educate America about this wonderful dream that was passed to us from generations past, this idea that America would be the city on the hill. It would be the light, the beacon promising freedom to all mankind. And for many years, that's what America was, and every country envied us, but that has all changed. Things have changed here in America very seriously. And, of course, unless you understand the Brotherhood of Darkness, you can't understand why things have changed. So we ask you, of course, to begin to study, to find out, to help us inform others, to talk to them, to learn how to talk to them, to explain really what's going on. And then we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival in our land, because if the American people don't turn back to God, do you really think that God will ever again bless this nation? We ask you to pray for our leaders. We ask you to pray for our ministers. But we ask you specifically to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, because we're on the front lines of this battle 5 hours every day, and then we do week programs on the weekends as well. So until tomorrow evening, we'll be back with you on this same station, whether it's our local station, the internet, on shortwave. This is Dr. Stan saying good night, and may the Lord be with you.